This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll learn about the number of Palestinians being held in Israeli jails.
Israeli jails, another word for a colonial prison system. Are they, quote, criminals or freedom fighters?
We'll have an update on the new film, We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks.
The title itself tells you more than you want to know. WikiLeaks didn't steal secrets. So what's the story with this film?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, over the past few weeks, we've talked a lot about the NYPD stop and frisk case that have been going through the courts here. But we haven't really talked much about the judge, Shira Shindlin, and she's made some bold statements in the last week or so.
We got lucky with her. They interviewed her in the Law Journal last week, and she talked about judges being appointed for life, and therefore they can do bold things. You know, they're not facing an election. She criticized other judges on the bench. And I predict that she's going to do a bold thing here with the stop and frisk case.
Well, she has made some comments that indicate she finds problems with the program, namely the number of young Latino and Black youths who were stopped. When police officers say, they say, for example, I saw a bulge in his pants in something like 80% of the cases, and then only a few result in there being a weapon.
Yeah. And then the testimony that comes in that the commanders in the station houses are ordering these cops to make these stop and frisks. The whole thing stinks. If you wanted to guess what judge in that courthouse would be the best judge, I think we got her. So I'm anticipating a good victory.
Michael, in a recent show, we had really positive news about the genocide trials in Guatemala.
An historic victory. The dictator of Guatemala in 1980 and 81 was found guilty of crimes against humanity and genocide for his overseeing the murder of the Ishmael villagers in the northwest part of the country. It was just an extraordinary victory. It's never happened before. Nevertheless, it hasn't stood.
We had some bad news a few days ago.
Well, their constitutional court, which presides over the sitting judge that decided this case, under pressure, and this is what was reported in the New York Times, this is not the speculation here of leftist lawyers, under pressure from what they called the business community and the military, overthrew the verdict and said that they have to have another trial because of some unnamed procedural difficulty. Meanwhile, Rios Montt, the dictator, is sitting in a military hospital prison. So is his intelligence director, Rodriguez, and they're going to have to be tried again. But this verdict didn't stand, but morally it stood, and the guy's still in the dock. So it's not a total reversal, but it does show you the nature of the forces in Guatemala and the relationship of forces.
And we'll have more to report on this in the weeks to come.
Absolutely.
Michael, last week a new film came out featuring our own Julian Assange. What do you think of it?
The film is called We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks. And it's a film by a well-known director, Alex Gibney, who actually won an Academy Award for an important film called Taxi to the Dark Side. Unfortunately, this film about WikiLeaks, Bradley Manning, and Julian Assange is a great disappointment, does a disservice to Bradley Manning and Julian Assange, as well as WikiLeaks. I think trivializes the incredible courage that both of them had, as well as what was revealed by these documents, both from Bradley Manning and Julian Assange. And when you say, Heidi, it features Julian Assange, it unfortunately doesn't feature Julian Assange, or maybe fortunately, considering the kind of what many would call a hatchet job that Gibney did on this film. Julian Assange declined being interviewed by Alex Gibney, and that may be what gave Alex Gibney an edge about how he dealt with Julian Assange in the film. Alex was well-funded for the film, but he didn't get an interview with anybody who is currently associated with WikiLeaks, including Julian Assange. And so this film doesn't really speak to what Julian Assange thinks or is about. And obviously, he didn't get an interview with Bradley Manning.
The other third person who's facing prison time is Jeremy Hammond for hacking into Stratfor and uploading to WikiLeaks. Was he mentioned in the film?
I don't think he's mentioned in the film. It was really mostly, as the title says, We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks. But let me just give you some of my observations on the film. I saw it in Sundance a couple of months ago. It was released on Friday, the 24th of May, and it'll be interesting to see what people think about the film. But the first thing that grabs you immediately is the title, We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks, as we all understand, is a publisher. It is not the organization, neither is Julian Assange, the person who took documents from the government when they supposedly had a security clearance. He's a publisher like the New York Times, like any other newspaper. And yet the film is entitled We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks. The implication is clear from that title, it seems to me, that WikiLeaks stole secrets. That's very bad for WikiLeaks for Julian Assange, because it plays into the government's theory here that somehow Julian Assange and WikiLeaks are co-conspirators with Bradley Manning in taking secrets.
And you know, Michael, this is actually quite timely because a Fox reporter has just been accused of conspiring with a source. I believe this is the first time the government, although it's gone after whistleblowers and tried to find source material, it's the first time I think that the government has accused a journalist of conspiring in terms of trying to bring materials out. So it seems kind of a disturbing trend.
I want to talk about
trend.
That, Heidi. It's okay. The Rosen case,
right.
And it's a Fox News reporter, yeah. And it's very important to talk about that. Before I do that, I want to talk about a couple of other points with regard to the implications that Julian Assange is someone who stole secrets. First is the title. Then there's two or three other places in the film where he again has that implication. Another place is where he says, and I'll read from what we took when we were at the film, the words of it. Here's what it says in the film. In this environment of expanding secrecy, Assange went fishing for secrets to publish. To bait whistleblowers, he published a list of the most wanted leaks. So in that one phrase, it says, Assange went fishing for secrets, and then he published a list of leaks he wanted. So it's implying that he solicited and pushed for what he was getting. And that'll get to the Rosen case. But it's already moving Assange from a publisher into somebody who's a co-conspirator and an aiding and abetter. And then he does, also says in the film, but in online chats with WikiLeaks, Manning's thoughts changed. Either he decided or he was persuaded that he should capture more flags, a lot more flags, referring to secrets. In other words, Julian Assange or somebody at WikiLeaks persuaded Manning. So you have we steal secrets, fishing, bait, and then persuaded. And then you have the government saying early on in the WikiLeaks revelations, saying that, well, we think by having that website, etc., Julian Assange was soliciting, and that may cross the line into aiding and abetting espionage, essentially, they said. And then it comes to the Rosen case. The Rosen case, a reporter for Fox News, a document surfaced within the last week or so that said that, yes, we're investigating who Rosen's sources were, and one of the things they did apparently to get the search warrant or to get whatever court order they got to get in, look at his phone logs, they said Rosen conceivably aiding and abetting espionage or a conspiracy to commit espionage. So here you have exactly what we feared was happening with publishers like WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, and we have open evidence that they're doing this to a reporter at Fox News. And what is shocking about this are two things. One is, of course, Fox News is now up in arms about it. But, of course, they were one of the news organizations that went after Julian Assange in the worst way, saying he should be 6 foot underground, he should be droned to death, etc. And, of course, now everybody should stand up for Rosen, as they should be standing up for WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. Because as soon as you start saying that let's take another example, James Risen at the New York Times. 4 years ago or 6 years ago, he publishes material about the warrantless wiretapping that is being carried on by the National Security Archives. I don't know how he got that information, but I presume it wasn't just dropped in the mail to the New York Times. He probably knew people at the National Security Agency. He talks to them. I don't know whether he says, what do you have for me? I don't know what he says.
He's an investigative journalist. He was doing his job.
Exactly right. So as soon as you put investigative journalists into the category of co-conspirators or aiders and abettors, whether it's James Risen or Julian Assange or Rosen, you're basically saying that's the end of investigative journalism. And with regard to the Department of Defense and war, that's the only way any information comes out about war in this country, about weapons, because everything is considered secret, everything. Back to the film. So We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks, is already putting Julian Assange in a place where the government would love to put him. So that's one of my very major criticisms of the film. A second aspect of the film is Bradley Manning. Oftentimes, the film uses rhetorical questions that Gibney, as narrator, sets out, and really contained within them is the answer of where he's going with the question, and then he then proves that. So with regard to Bradley Manning, he talks about Bradley Manning's motivation for leaking these hundreds of thousands of documents. And he goes through the film saying, was it political or was it because of all his problems? And here's the way he asked the question, and there's other places as well. Just what had happened with Bradley Manning? Was this just a data dump? Or was this the act of a man who had peeked behind the curtain of a superpower and decided what it was doing was wrong? And then he goes into the motivations of Bradley Manning, and he spends a significant part of the film on all of Bradley Manning's psychological problems, his gender issues, and everything else. I don't know what he's done with this latest version. I saw maybe it's the same one I saw, but I don't know what he's done with the incredible statement by Bradley Manning on the political basis for what he did.
Manning's statement in the court.
That's right. The one where he went through each set of documents and said, I did this because I didn't like seeing people murdered in the collateral murder video. I didn't like seeing us targeting people in Iraq.
He laid out the moral and political
grounds for it. And yet the film goes through a lot of this stuff around this gender and issues of that came out at the pretrial, but that actually all came out and happened to Bradley after he had actually given this material to WikiLeaks. In that context, Gibney has given some interviews since the film because he knows his position is going to be controversial, but he doesn't pull back. So here's what he says in an interview in the Daily Beast about Bradley Manning. I think he was alienated. He was in agony personally over a number of issues. He was lonely and needy, had an identity crisis, etc. And then this is all Gibney speaking. And then he says, I think it raises big issues about who whistleblowers are, because they are alienated people who don't get along with people around them, which motivates them to do what they do. This is Alex Gibney speaking to the Daily Beast. Well, when people do things, it's obviously complex. All of us, you could probably go from Martin Luther King to George Washington and the cherry tree and come up with different motivations why different people act. But in this case, Gibney is giving an opinion that it's the personal identity crisis that he's supposedly going through that gave him the impetus to release all these documents. Pretty outrageous position and pretty demeaning, in my view, of the real motivation that Bradley Manning himself put forward for why he did this.
It's akin to an ad hominem attack and not addressing the substance.
I just want to give a few other points in the film. A third point in the film is he basically says WikiLeaks is dead, that it was killed by Julian Assange and his what he calls Julian Assange's corruption. And he goes through whatever he thinks doesn't mean financial because there doesn't seem to be anything around that, but just what he calls his corruption. And he basically says he killed WikiLeaks and it's dead. And of course, what killed WikiLeaks? It's not killed, for let's start there. So he's wrong about it being killed, and I'll address that. But to the extent it had problems, it's because the U.S. was so upset and angry about what happened. So they encouraged the cutting off of all the, you know, PayPal went ahead and MasterCard to cut off all its financial resources. They started a criminal grand jury investigation.
They launched a full-scale attack.
Yeah, a full-scale attack. They started going after his supporters, etc. So if we're going to talk about what hurt WikiLeaks, it's not the figure of Julian Assange. It's what the U.S. government has done. But the idea, he says in the film, and when he speaks of it being dead, WikiLeaks, despite that special relationship, talking about a matter with Sweden or something, Assange desperately fought extradition to Sweden and lost every appeal. His legal battle drained his finances and trapped him at the family farm over a year. Hoped for funding didn't come, and WikiLeaks suspended operation. His international organization had blown apart. Let's just look at what's happened. Since that, what has WikiLeaks done? It's done incredible work. Since December 2011, they released what are called the spy files, which are the companies and corporations that sell spying equipment all over the world, surveillance equipment. They released the Stratfor emails, 5 million emails, not all yet released, but being released periodically, of a private intelligence company that had amazing material in them. They're dubbed the GIF files, GIF files. The Syria files, the emails about what was going on in Syria. And in April 2013, what we call Cablegate or the Kissinger files, 1.7 million files, highly searchable, about what happened when Kissinger was both head of, I think he was at that point, he was both State Department as well as National Security Advisor, 73 to 76. So this is an organization the film Gibney calls dead, and yet it's as active as I've ever seen. So one of the things that Alex has to prove in this film to prove his thesis is that Julian is in that embassy in Ecuador in London because he's afraid of going to Sweden because he doesn't want to answer questions about the allegations of sexual misconduct in Sweden. Now, Julian has offered to answer those questions. He doesn't want to go to Sweden to do that because he knows, and I know, that that's a one-way ticket to the United States where there's a serious effort to prosecute him. And he will probably spend the rest of his life in prison here if convicted. So what he has to do to be able to prove that is diminish the prospect for prosecution of Julian Assange in the United States. It's ridiculous. I mean, there's everything going on from a grand jury, likely indictment, Stratfor saying in one of the documents that there's a sealed indictment against Julian, to his associates and friends being picked up. But here's what it says in the film. The biggest mystery of all was the role of the United States. He calls it a mystery. Over 2 years after the first leak, no charges had been filed by the U.S. Assange claimed that the U.S. was biding his time, waiting for him to go to Sweden, but there was no proof. So there's three things in that one sentence in which Gibney is trying to prove that he's in that embassy to avoid Sweden, but there's no worry about the United States, or it's just complete speculation. Mystery, no charges, and biding his time. Well, there's no mystery about the United States. It's all public record. The grand jury we know about, the witnesses called, we know a number of them. We know which associates have been stopped. We know subpoenas have been issued to Twitter and Google, etc. We know at the Bradley Manning trial, they said they were investigating the leading officers, etc., of WikiLeaks. And as late as a couple of months ago, on March 26, 2013, they confirmed that they have a continuing investigation, criminal investigation of WikiLeaks. So there's no mystery. Then this statement that somehow Gibney knows there's no charges filed against Julian Assange. How does he know that? It's a secret grand jury. And if there's an indictment, it's going to be a sealed indictment because they never let an indictment become public when a person is not in their custody, because then the person will never get to a place where they can grab them. So how Gibney knows that there's no charges, the answer is he doesn't know. He's doing a rhetorical device to simply try and say, oh, Julian Assange has nothing to fear. It's all paranoia that there might be charges against him. So again, completely disingenuous. Then he says there's no proof that the U.S. was biding its time and waiting to actually start an extradition proceeding against Julian Assange in releasing the indictment. Despite his statement that there's no proof the U.S. was biding its time, the U.S. actually said it was biding its time. They said that on BBC in 2011, that they'd wait to see what happened in Sweden, and that was revealed recently again, that they were waiting to see the outcome of the other charges before they actually did anything to get a hold of Julian Assange. From a legal perspective, that makes sense, because if they were to file another extradition while the first one is pending to Sweden, then the court is put in a pickle of which one to honor first and what it does. And as long as the U.S. has him, or they thought they had him, under surveillance or with an ankle bracelet on in the U.K., they figured, why worry about it? He was then have to go to Sweden. But now they're not in that situation, but he still is in the Ecuador embassy where he can't leave. So Gibney purposely lessens any kind of possibility of criminal charges against Julian in the United States to try and argue that he's paranoid or that he's just trying to avoid going to Sweden. It's, again, I would say, a complete, you know, misunderstanding, not the true story of what's going on.
It sounds as though you're saying this is an irresponsibly produced film, Michael.
Well, I would say this. It's a very unfair film to Julian Assange and Bradley Manning. It's filled with omissions, with
speculation.
It's filled with omissions, speculation, trivializes what was done by Manning and Assange by trying to focus on what I think is a false picture of their personal lives or their motivations. But it therefore trivializes the larger picture. It's actually shocking that someone of what I thought was someone who had done a film like Taxi to the Dark Side would do something to this on what I consider to be one of the most important political issues of our time.
What he's done, to the extent that public opinion can protect Julian Assange here in the United States, what he's done is he's whittled away at that support of public opinion and greased the skids for Julian Assange. And I would say that that's worse than irresponsible.
To the extent anybody sees this film, and I don't recommend it, see it with your eyes wide open. See it after you listen to this, if you're going to see it at all, and after a number of people, I think, will write a decent analysis of what this film really is about. In fact, part of the film, of course, has some of the good stuff they did. Gibney builds up what Manning and Assange did in the beginning to show they revealed some important material, and he does that almost to then sort of demean them toward the latter part of the film.
So that's three thumbs down. On April 17th, hundreds of Palestinians filled the streets in the West Bank in protest to mark Palestinian Prisoners' Day. Right now, there are nearly 5,000 Palestinian security prisoners held in Israeli jails, 13 of whom are women. More than half have been convicted, 33% have not been sentenced, and 3% are being held in administrative detention. In addition, 235 of Palestinian prisoners are minors, ranging in age from 14 to 18 years. We talk today with human rights lawyer Sahar Francis, director of the Palestinian NGO, ADAMER. It's an organization offering legal services to political prisoners under Israeli occupation and represents prisoners in Israeli military and civil courts. Sahar Francis, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
We'd like to start with an overview of the situation of Palestinians being imprisoned in Israeli jails. We don't really know that much about it. What are the numbers like? What are the conditions like? And most important, why are they there?
Actually, currently there's 4,900 Palestinian prisoners still inside Israel in the Israeli prisons. Most of them, they are adults. There's 236 minors under age 18, 14 women and 14 Palestinian parliamentarians, 168 under administrative detention, that this is indefinite detention without any charges, actually. The majority of them, I would say, they are arrested because of political activism and being involved in the peaceful struggle, resistance, especially in the last couple of years against the wall, the checkpoints, the settlements, land confiscation, house demolitions, all these practices of the occupation. There's like attack against all the kind of different civil activism against the occupation in the occupied territories.
A question, were most of these people picked up, detained from the occupied territories or from within Israel?
Definitely from the majority of them, they would be detained from the occupied territories. Of course, it's including as well Jerusalem residents that they are living in the city of Jerusalem. They would be arrested inside Israel in Jerusalem, but they could be subjected for two different legal systems. One, the Israeli civil system or the military system that applies just to the occupied territories, because this is a little bit complicated. We have two different legal systems in the occupied territories. Settlers, for example, they are not subjected to the military court system that is imposed on Palestinians in the occupied territories. So any Israeli settler that commits a crime, he would be brought inside Israel to be prosecuted in the civil court system.
But these people are actually tried in the occupied territories?
They are tried in these military courts, but it's also a violation for the international law to move them to prisons inside Israel. This is what Israel was doing since 1995. They moved all the Palestinian political prisoners from the occupied territories to prisons inside Israel, and this is a violation for the Fourth Geneva Convention, actually.
Yeah. Now, the numbers seem very large to me. 4,000 is a huge number. Can you give us some sense of the number of years people have been there? and what the prison conditions are like?
Actually, this number is a very decreasing number comparing to the previous years. In 2005, 2006, we used to have 11,000 Palestinian prisoners imprisoned in the Israeli prisons. And if you take the statistics since 67 till today, more than 750,000 Palestinians were arrested. It's almost hitting every Palestinian house. It's estimated to be around 40% of the Palestinian men population that they were at least once incarcerated in their life. And actually, the current number is, I think, the less in the last 10 years of being, since the break of the Second Intifada, the number was increasing. In the time of the Oslo, in the 7 years of Oslo, Israel kept 1,500 political prisoners. Now we can say that the majority of these prisoners are sentenced, as I said before, for studential activism, for political activism. The majority of them, they would be sentenced for periods less than 10 years. There's around 430 of them, or 44, that they are sentenced for life sentences. And you can get a life sentence if you're involved in activities that not definitely cause death. Like, you would be involved in military activities, but not definitely with death or injury, because it's enough, according to the military orders, to be involved in planning for military activities. And it depends how serious the plan was in order to be facing life sentence. And the life sentence in Israel, it's 99 years. It's open. It's not limited for 20 years or 30 years.
Did I hear you correctly say 750,000 have been arrested?
All these years of the occupation, correct. It's hitting every Palestinian house. And there's some houses where you have four people, five people in the same time arrested. We still have cases of families that they have four sons or five sons in the same time in prison. And the family would end up, like the mother would end up all the week traveling from one prison to another because they wouldn't be held in the same prison. In some cases, they would be distributed in all the different prisons from north up to south in Israel. And the mother would be traveling all the way along all the week just trying to visit them.
What about the members of parliament that you mentioned who are in prison? That seems to be quite extraordinary. In this country, in most of the world, parliamentary members have immunity. But it seems to me that you're going to tell me that because of their political situation, they're arrested and put in jail.
Of course. And actually, Israel don't admit this immunity of parliamentarians when it comes for the Palestinian parliamentarians. The case was that even before the election of 2006, they were arresting parliamentarians in the past. After the election of 2006, actually, Marwan Barghouti was already there. So Marwan Barghouti was elected while he was in prison for the second time. Ahmed Saadat was elected, the head of the PFLP, was elected while he was already imprisoned. But the majority of the current parliamentarians, the others, they were elected from the Reform and Change Party that Israel claimed later on that it's affiliated with Hamas. At the time when they arrested 48 parliamentarians from the Reform and Change Party in June 2006, the party wasn't declared as illegal per se. They were associating it with Hamas and claiming, since you are associated with Hamas, this is the reason for your arrest. Later, a year later, they declared about the Reform and Change Party that ran and won the election as illegal party. So now, eight of these parliamentarians, they are under administrative detention. So it means they don't have clear charges against them. Even they are not charging them that they are members of Hamas. They're arresting them under administrative detention. Like the others, they are facing charges of being members of Hamas and supporting illegal party, which is Hamas or the Reform and Change in this case.
And you said 13 are women. That's a low number. What were those women brought in for?
Actually, before the exchange deal with Shalit, the number of the women were much higher. We used to have 120 female prisoners, but they started to release them in the Shalit exchange deal. And Israel kept three Palestinian women after the exchange deal. Now they arrested other women. Most of them, they would be involved either in political activism, mainly supporting their brothers or their husbands in their political activism, or in some cases they are involved in trying to stab soldiers or settlers in the occupied territories.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with attorney Sahar Francis. We'll be right back after this break. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Speaking with Sahar Francis, who's an attorney, an Israel-Palestinian woman who's here in the United States. She is the director of an NGO called Adamer. And Sahar, I wanted to ask you if you could tell us a little bit about your organization and how you got to be what you're doing.
Adamer was established in Jerusalem in late 1991, by ex-prisoners, Palestinian political prisoners, and lawyers who were aiming to give legal support, free legal support for the Palestinian prisoners under the military court system. Since then, our main focus is the legal work that we are offering for these prisoners and their families. We developed the programs to include as well monitoring, documentation, advocacy, raising awareness, and campaigning on behalf of the political prisoners, and we are still doing it since 20 years.
Do you take on particular cases, or is it more to raise awareness of the situation as a whole?
No, sometimes we take particular cases, but our focus is on the political arrests, also under the Palestinian Authority. It means that after the establishment of the Palestinian Authority, we started to follow as well cases of Palestinian prisoners that they would be arrested by the PA because of their political activism and political affiliation.
And how many lawyers do you have in your organization?
We are 8 lawyers.
And are you all Palestinians?
Yes, some of us, they are Palestinian Israelis, so we are members of the Israeli Bar Association, and some we are members of the Palestinian Bar Association.
Is it more difficult to represent prisoners in the Israeli military court versus the civil court?
Definitely, because these are two different systems, and legally on the procedures level, there's also discriminating policies between the two different systems and the way how the military court would take the evidences or the rules of evidences and the witnesses. And I would say if you take the level of indictment in the military court, it's a very huge level. Most of the cases would end in the military court after plea bargain without even exhausting the system, because neither the prisoners or the lawyers don't have much trust in this system that it would be objective and fair system in order to seek justice after exhausting these cases.
How's it decided who goes to which court? Who makes the decision whether you go to a military court or an Israeli civil court?
It's mainly the military prosecution with the security service people that they do the interrogation. So you could be ending up interrogated in the in detention centers inside Israel with the security interrogation people. And then they will decide whether to transfer the case for the civil prosecution or the military prosecution.
So they decide what's going to work better for them. them, essentially.
Exactly. Yes, and actually, for the Jerusalem residents and some of the Palestinians from the West Bank, they would be interrogated according to the military system, even if the act happened inside Israel, because according to the military system, you can have them under interrogation for longer period, like around 90 days before charging the person, where in the civil system, it's 30 days, and in security cases, 35 days, and then you have to charge them in front of the court. So they take the advantage of keeping people for 90 days, and then they would bring them to the district court inside Jerusalem to be trialed in the civil system. So it would be more effective to have more time in the time of the interrogation according to the military system, and then switch to the civil system.
Now, I remember when I saw the film, which I know you're familiar with, Law in These Parts. Which
amazing
a
film.
Remarkable film, really out of the mouths of the very military judges and others who try and deal and interrogate Palestinian prisoners. And, of course, by the end of the film, it talked about torture as a method of interrogation. And I'm just interested in, of the 4,000 that are remaining, and even what's current today, what we now call in this country enhanced interrogation techniques instead of torture, where are you with that issue with regard to these Palestinian prisoners?
In our place, it's called moderate physical pressure, by the way. And
it
never
is called that? Wow.
Yes. And even the High Court in Israel was never admitting that they were using severe physical torture in the 80s and the 90s, that people died out of this use of severe torture. After the decision of the High Court in 1999 on the issue of torture, where the High Court actually said that there's several methods that they couldn't be used anymore, like the shaking, the tying in the small chair, sleep deprivation for several days, and painful tying in very painful position. But actually, they kept a gap for the interrogators to use these methods in what so far they call it ticking bomb cases, without the court defining what could be considered as a ticking bomb case. So we ended up that the interrogators has a very wide variety of cases where they can claim that this is a ticking bomb case and use these typical techniques of torture. They also granted them amnesty, like we cannot sue them because the interrogators can claim that out of defense necessity we used the torture. The latest case that was Arafat Jaradat, who died actually after 5 days in interrogation in the Jelami detention center last March, and the guy collapsed out of this physical pressure with the psychological pressure for the isolation for a long period. They claimed that he died out of heart attack, but in the autopsy it was clear that there's no sign for heart attack.
And I was going to ask, have there been other deaths in custody?
All these years, more than around 70 people actually died in prison. The number is much higher, but it's more than 100 something. But there are some cases that they were dying out of health neglect. And the latest case was Maysara Abu Hamdiye, that he was discovered as a cancer case a couple of months before his death. And he was never released to get treatment, neither offered proper treatment in the detention. So he ended up dying a month after Arafat, actually, of health neglect.
Sahir, what you've been describing, we've been describing with respect to how the United States treats prisoners in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, the military detentions, the physical pressure, the military courts, using whatever court is best for them. It's a pattern.
Part of the lessons came from the Israelis. After 9/11, mm-hmm. there was a team of Israelis that came to the United States.
I'm sure there was coordination,
right,
and sharing experiences, because seeing the photos of Abu Ghraib with this sack on the detainees' heads, this was used in the Palestinian case since the early years of the occupation. This was the method how to prevent them from breathing, from sleeping, and they were tied in these kindergarten small chairs with the sack on their head, with playing music 24 hours a day, very loud music, in order to prevent them from having rest. And then after being tied in these positions for 2 weeks, the interrogator will come and shake you from your clothes in the... And one of the detainees in 95, Abdus Samad Hirizat, broke his neck and died. And then why the we intensified then the petitions to the High Court, and it was just after 99 that the court admitted that these techniques are used in interrogation, and they said no more shaking, but just in ticking bomb cases.
Right, but they gave amnesty to the
for the torturers. Interrogators, exactly.
Yeah. We
the
call person, that looking forward, not backward in the United States. That's Obama's formulation.
Actually, if we take the statistics of the Committee Against Torture in Israel, it's an Israeli organization that deals just with torture cases. In the last 10 years, they were filling more than 600 cases of torture and ill treatment. No one single case was ending up with real accountability to the perpetrators in the Israeli system. So they do have system of criminal investigation on these cases, but it never ends up in a proper way because mostly it's controlled by the security service itself. Like they are interrogating themselves about these cases of torture and ill treatment. So how come you can expect that this system would be objective and justice, offering justice at the end?
We started by you mentioning there were 11,000 at one point, shortly, I guess, after the Second Intifada. Is that right?
Yeah.
And now it's around 4,000. And while we're hearing a lot of, you know, awful stuff, there's obviously been a movement toward releasing a certain number. And I gather, because there was a demonstration, I guess, on April 17th of this year by the Palestinian Prisoners Day, in which there was at least some kind of a mass protest around this. So can you talk about the actions that people are doing to end this, really?
Actually, let me start by reflecting a bit about the Israeli policy when it comes for mass releases and political exchange deals. Actually, the Israelis always find their way how to bypass these agreements by rearresting either the same people as they did with the case of the exchange deal in Shalit case. They already arrested 14 people after the exchange deal. One of them, Samer Issawi, that was involved in the longest hunger strike. Sometimes in between the different exchanges, they would be launching mass incarceration in different villages in order to keep the number on certain level, around 5,000 or so. So there's no guarantee that if they will implement these releases that it will be over. I think the main problem with the Palestinian side was when agreeing in the Oslo process that the Israelis could keep this ability of arresting people, raiding Palestinian cities, and that the Palestinian political side couldn't succeed on enforcing Israel to stop totally the policy of the imprisonment. So this is why the people would demand in such the Prisoners' Day or in the hunger strike time that we should solve this issue now. If you are talking about going back to the negotiations, the Palestinian Authority is supposed to bring the issue of the prisoners as the first issue in the even before going back to real negotiations to request mass releases, because the majority of these people are not involved in serious issues. The majority of them, they are just arrested for minor activities that there's no reason why to keep them for several years in detention.
The Palestinian Prisoners Day, can you talk about that?
Actually, it's a memory of the first Palestinian prisoner who was released, Hijazi, I forget his first name, as an exchange agreement between the Palestinians and the Israelis back in the 80s. So then they started to took the day of his release, the 17th of April, as the day of the Palestinian political prisoners. So we started to promote and lobby on this issue. So now it's accepted everywhere in the world. And lots of activists, they are supporting the Palestinian prisoners movement, especially in the 17th of April. And we want to make it like our ambition is to have a continuous campaign for the release of all the Palestinian political prisoners and not just around the 17th of April.
Were there demonstrations within Israel as well as the occupied territories?
But mostly in Israel, handled by the Palestinian community, with the most left Israeli activist groups supporting this. The issue of the Palestinian prisoners in the Israeli society became a little bit complicated in the Second Intifada. More they look at these people as terrorists and not as people who were arrested because of the self-determination issue and the occupation and the political discourse.
Talk to us about the several hundred children that are in Israeli prisons.
The main problem with the justice system when it comes for children cases that Israel wasn't admitting that the Palestinian children, these should be under age 18, as it is accepted in the international law. For all these years, till actually 2011, September 2011, Israel was treating the Palestinian minors, people under 16, just, and all the category between 16 and 18, they were treated as adults. Currently, they have a special court for minors, but it's handled by the same prosecutors, the same judges. So actually, it's just a kind of reaction to the pressure, the international pressure, that how come you trial children with the adults in the same courts? They separated them in one room that is called now the courtroom for the children cases, but it's the same judges. There's nothing special in the procedures offered for these children. They just increased the age of minority, so now it's 18. But on the level of sentences, if you arrested as a child, but you became as an adult in the time of the trial, your sentence would be taken as you are an adult, which means you could be sentenced for 10 years or more and not as a child. In Israel, the age that matters is the age when you committed the act, not when you are about to be sentenced. So this is as well discrimination. In Israel, when you arrest a child within 12 hours, you have to bring him in to the court. You cannot keep him in the police station more than 12 hours. In the Palestinian case, it was 8 days. Just last September, they changed it to be 2 days for the minors. So still they can keep them 48 hours without being brought to the court. There's no limitation on the ability to interrogate them on like late hours at night. In Israel, you cannot interrogate a minor at such hours if his one of his parents or his lawyer is not present in the interrogation session, while this guarantee is not offered for the Palestinian cases. In Israel, they should tape the interrogation sessions in order to guarantee that there's no torture. This is not existing in the Palestinian prisoners' cases, neither children, neither adults. So these are the kinds of discriminating policies in the two different systems.
We have a famous case here in New York City called the Central Park jogger case, where they did what you just described to several children. It got confessions out of them because of the pressure they can put on them when they're isolated from their parents and a lawyer, and put them in prison unfairly. And I imagine that happens all the time in Israel. But I wanted to ask you about your tour. You're here in May in New York City. What have you been accomplishing? What's your reaction been to the audience you've been speaking to here in the United States?
My tour started 2 weeks ago in the Bay Area, and it was mainly doing public gatherings and meetings, as well meeting with local organizations dealing with the prisoners' justice system here in the United States. So what we are trying to do is doing this comparison between policies used in the Israeli-Palestinian context and policies here, like mass incarceration, solitary confinement, indefinite detention, like the detention in Guantanamo, the experience of hunger strike, the different punishments that these political prisoners could face in these prisons, and in order to discuss how we can fight these policies jointly as human rights activists, whether in the Palestinian occupied territories or here in the United States.
Could you speak briefly about the families that are left behind when, say, a husband or a father is incarcerated? Is there any support network for the women who are left?
There's, for some limit, I wouldn't say that this is a satisfying network that is built there. Mostly the support would be, for example, on the economical level for the families from the Palestinian Ministry of Prisoners, trying to support, especially in the cases where you would have the main income resource person that he works. And it's in most of the cases, actually, the men that they would be working. But I mean, on the social, on the psychological level of it, there's a huge gap for and lack of proper services that they would be offered for the family members, especially for children, that they will be disconnected from their father or their mother if the mother is arrested for long periods, especially when they reach certain age and they would be not allowed to visit and to have physical contact with the father, like after being 16, suddenly you would stop getting the special permits to do the visits in the prison. And beyond the age 10, you can't have physical, even sex now. They reduced the age to be 6 years old, where you can have physical touch with your father when visiting him. And it's just for 10 minutes. So imagine the impact about the young children, that they would separated from their fathers or their mothers, that they even cannot hug them, cannot have any physical contact, and the conversation is just over a phone, and it would be like sometimes cut, sometimes it's just for 30 minutes. It's not happening very often, like it's not every month. Sometimes you would get the chance, if you have security problems, just to have the visit 4 times a year or 3 times a year. So I think there's a huge impact on the Palestinian community. And this is one of the reasons why Israel was using mass incarceration policies all these years, because they are totally aware about this impact. And imagine the impact on the children, that they end up imprisoned. How serious this experience would be, and how serious it will affect their life even after being released. And this is why I think we cannot ignore this aspect of the purpose to destroy the whole community behind the mass incarceration. It's not just about security. No, it's not that they are really in serious need to arrest all these thousands of people to protect their own security. No, it's done in order to break down the Palestinian society, actually.
I want to go back to when you talked about your tour here and looking at how the U.S. uses its incarceration system, Guantanamo and our solitary, et cetera. And of course, as you know, we're in the midst of a hunger strike now at Guantanamo. 100 people or more detainees are on hunger strike, almost over 100 days now. And they're doing force feeding. And I know I occasionally follow the people in Palestine who are on hunger strikes, but the news is sort of sporadic, and I never really have a handle of what's going on it, and is there force feeding, or what happens in Palestine?
Actually, in the past, because the history of hunger strike in Palestine, also a long history, they started to use this strategy of resistance in the early years, in the 70s. And in the past, they were using force feeding, but in the 80s, 3 prisoners died of force feeding. So the High Court ruled that this is illegal, and this is should be coming after a decision of a medical committee that should check case per case and should be done in the hospital, and not by forcing through the tongue or like the mouth or the nose. It should be done through the main vein, actually, as a technique. So actually what happened in the latest hunger strikes, they were discussing in certain cases where people reached 60 days or 70 days, but at the end they never force feed anyone of the Palestinian hunger strikers. And they were just offering them glucose or any other minerals as supplements, but not force feeding, no.
I wonder whether you could tell us something about your career and how you got to be, what you are today, a human rights lawyer, but a Palestinian in Israel. That's a tough job. What was it that got you to where you are?
Honestly, when I studied law in the Haifa University at the 3rd year, I remember one of my professors, he was working with the Israeli Human Rights, ACRI, the Israeli Association for Human Rights, and he was representing a Palestinian female prisoner that she was isolated as a punishment, separated from the rest of the Palestinian female prisoners, and they needed someone to translate in the court. And he brought me to translate, and I was amazed by the discussion and the situation and the things that she was bringing about the conditions in the prison and in the this related issue of being isolated in very humiliating conditions while she's a religious person, that she was telling the judge, I cannot even practice my religious daily life because of this isolation. And this is why he decided to take her out of isolation at the end. So I think this is how I started to be connected to the prisoners' issue. But then I went to Jerusalem to work with the Society of St. Eve when I finished my law degree. And it was an organization, Catholic organization, dealing with general human rights issues in the occupied territories. So I decided to move to work on the occupied territories as a human rights lawyer from the beginning. But then in 96, 97, some of my friends in Beit Lahem and Ramallah started to be arrested. So it brought me back to the issue of the prisoners. And since then, I went deeply in the with the Damir. I started with the Damir back in 1998, actually. I was volunteering before with the Damir in 96. But 98, I just started full-time job with them.
Sahar, what motivates you in a very depressing area? What sustains you and keeps you going through this?
I think that justice and the basic human rights standards that keeps you fighting for guaranteeing these rights, like you cannot give up. The way how you see the apartheid policies, grave violations of human rights taking place there, and I think you should be believing strongly in the human rights. Otherwise, you would be so depressed and you cannot continue. So this is what keeps me, actually.
As we close the interview, can you give our listeners some way they can find out more, help out? Where can they go? What website?
Definitely. Actually, in Damir, we have a current campaign about several campaigns, actually, about administrative detention, for example. We are opposing the policy of indefinite detention. We have a campaign against G4S, the company, that international company that is involved in security stuff. And we are promoting PDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions through these corporations and international companies that are complicit with the occupation issues. We are campaigning as well for the human rights defenders that they end up arrested, like our colleague Ayman Nasser. He's the field researcher in Damir. He was arrested in October. We have another colleague from Stop the Wall campaign that currently also he's arrested. So we promote human rights defenders cases. So mainly you can visit our website. It's www.addamir.org. You can find also contacts with other Palestinian NGOs that would be working on children issues, in women issues, in general human rights issues, if you are interested.
A-G-G-A-M-E-R.
A-D-D-A-M-E-R.ps.
We will link to that website on ours. Did you have a final thought that you wanted to share with us?
I think it was a great opportunity to give me this space to discuss the issue of the Palestinian political prisoners, and I'm sure this is will bring some change in the future in the reality and support our cause to get our self-determination.
Thank you for the work you do.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Justice.